Hello, listeners. This is David Blakesley coming at you with episode 59 of the Criterion Reflections podcast. On today's episode, we are going to be talking about a very early film of Werner Herzog called Fata Morgana, which I guess is translated as Mirage. I don't know if Fata Morgana is like Latin or German or what it is.
Spanish. But
Spanish. Okay, Spanish. And it's a word translated as Mirage, and we'll kind of unpack how that particular title applies to this film. But before we get into the discussion proper, let's introduce our guest. This is David Seeley, a first-time guest here on the podcast and a first-time podcaster, too. So feel very privileged to welcome David personally into this podcasting world as a participant, not just as a listener. David, welcome to Criterion Reflections. It's really good to have you on.
Yeah, thank you. It's really nice to be here. It's nice to have a conversation with you, David. We've exchanged a few had a few exchanges on social media a few times, but it's nice to, as a longtime listener, to actually have a conversation with you.
Well, I really do appreciate this ability that podcasting gives me to connect with folks I've gotten to know, folks with whom I share a common interest in these great films from the Criterion Collection, and it is fun to get your voice in a digital form and have a conversation that's preserved for the ages. So good to have you with us, and I'm definitely very interested in hearing what you have to say about Werner Herzog. But before we get into that, tell us just a little bit about yourself. You're speaking to me from England, and we've worked out our time zone differences. That's all fine, but tell us just a little bit about who you are, and let listeners know who they're listening to.
Well, basically, I live in the UK, but I'm an expat Canadian, actually. I was born in London, Ontario, and I grew up over there, and I came over to England about, I think this is 23 years now. I moved over here with an old girlfriend and ended up settling down, and I've been here for quite a few years now. And I work just in technology support in the finance industry. So I'm not a finance guy. I'm just I just support their endeavors, and that's how I earn my keep. And in my spare time, just like yourself, I sort of am a film enthusiast and a music enthusiast, and I do a little bit of amateur dramatics, and I've got two young kids as well, so they keep me quite busy. I'm kind of a full-time dad. So that's me, really. I in terms of my background with film, I actually did go to film school many years ago back in Canada. And I spent a few years kind of working in kind of the film industry just as on crews and things like that. But then ultimately I gravitated towards working in the home video industry, just in the early days of VHS, where we used to master and manufacture the videos. So, and then from there, when I moved to the UK, I sort of spent a bit more time working, sort of doing a bit of documentary filmmaking and things like that. And then I moved into more the technology support and things like that. So, in a nutshell, that's me.
Yeah, a film enthusiast. Hello. and a fan who just basically likes thinking a little extra and talking a little bit more about these great films. And I've certainly gotten to know you in some of the Criterion Facebook groups and things of that sort. I think that's probably where we've made our most direct connection. And I do appreciate your listening in on my various podcast ventures over the past several years. So, like I say, it's good to get you in the mix here. And we are going to talk about early films of Werner Herzog. For many years, of course, I think he's been one of those directors that seems like he'd be a very natural fit for the Criterion Collection. His films definitely have that art house sensibility, but he's also got this incredible kind of personal aura, reputation. He's had a really fascinating life and career, but for various rights issues, I'm sure Herzog himself has never been, or his films have never been properly released in physical media format by Criterion. And a few years ago, there was a pretty beautiful box set put out by Shout Factory that contains, 16 Herzog films, starting yes. from his earliest features, Even Dwarf Started Small, and up to My Best Fiend from 1999. So I'm kind of covering pretty comprehensively the first 30 years, I guess it would be, of Herzog's career. Not everything that he's released during that time, but the key feature films, including, you know, fictional narrative films as well as documentaries, and a number of films that kind of blurred the lines between those two distinct categories. But we were treated to a pretty rich release of Herzog films on the Criterion Channel. Again, it's not available over on your side of the pond there, David, but it is an officially affiliated Criterion set of films now. And I think, you know, I should probably have done a little bit more homework. I think the Criterion Channel offerings pretty much mirror what's in this Shout Factory set. Burden of Dreams, I guess I should mention, is a film, a documentary about the making of Fitzcarraldo that was released on physical media by Criterion. It's a Les Blank documentary, actually, kind of an interesting crossover of those two particular filmmakers. But that's kind of the context, and that's why we're talking about Fata Morgana. That's the second film in the set, or actually it's the third if you go by the listing. There's another one called The Land of Silence and Darkness, but from what I could tell, Fata Morgana achieved its release earlier than Land of Silence and Darkness. So I imagine these films were probably all made in the late 60s, early 70s, and then getting them released was a whole other piece of business. But that's a little bit of background.
Yes, actually, there's quite a lot of interesting, as I've been reading a little bit of background about the films, it's quite an interesting history about the challenges that he had in getting the films shown, especially in his native Germany. And apparently they've been much more better received internationally than they have in his home country. So there's quite a lot of interesting sort of challenges that he's had over the years, just both in making the films and in getting them distributed and exhibited.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us a little bit more about that. I mean, maybe you could even start by just kind of what's your overall take on Herzog? I mean, he's definitely a legendary director, a living legend. He's still with us, still seems to be pretty actively working. Of course, he's getting up there in years. But at the time of this film, he really was not anybody, you know, all that famous. So these films, early films, kind of helped make that reputation. But what's your kind of overall appreciation or opinion on Herzog as a creative force?
Well, definitely for me, Werner Herzog is one of my absolute favorite film directors, actually. I think he is singularly unique in his approach to his material and in his vision for things. He always seems to find very unique takes on whatever story he's telling or whatever sort of situation he's in. And he also seems to be someone who's quite admirably, I don't know what the right word would be, determination. He has a lot of determination and a lot of, you could almost say, stubbornness in terms of realizing his visions, whatever they may be, and whatever the circumstances might be, that even under quite arduous circumstances, he seems to really make something out of even the worst circumstances and sometimes even complete disasters. And he manages to somehow go with the spirit of the moment and create something that's really quite interesting. And even in some of his films that maybe don't work so well, there's always something really fascinating, interesting about the films, even his kind of worst ones, if you will.
Yeah, I think the word fanaticism kind of comes to my mind. You know? and in both the, you know, positive as well as somewhat perhaps the, you know, the less admirable aspects, that zeal, that drive, that perseverance that you've kind of referenced there, determination just to get it done. He does. He puts himself and has for many years. In fact, even before he was a filmmaker, he was doing some pretty interesting things. And before he was maybe established as a filmmaker, I think he started making his earliest films when he was still a teenager. He stole a camera, actually, but he felt very entitled to it because that was just his destiny. He just said he had to do this. So yeah, he was born in Germany, moved to the United States as a young man, but really did a lot of, you know, international travel. Just, you know, his Wikipedia biography, which is linked in the show notes, will, if you're not familiar with the backstory, and I'm really just beginning my studies, and I'm excited that we'll be following Herzog through these early films here on the podcast and in upcoming episodes, as that reputation really got established by some pretty pivotal works and has really continued to this day. I saw one of your social media posts. You had two different Herzog collections. How much of an overlap is there between the Shout Factory set that I've already described and this other big box that I saw in that photo you posted the other day?
Well, yeah, as I'm in the UK, I have a lot of BFI titles, and that particular box set, which came out roughly around the same time period that the Shout Factory set came out, there is quite a lot of overlap with the sort of the key films, like the sort of Aguirre and Nosferatu and Fitzcarraldo, and sort of the sort of the major titles that people are most familiar with. But I think the advantage between the two sets is that they both have cover some ground that the other doesn't. So although it might seem slightly extravagant to have the two sets, they actually do contain a lot of unique material between them. The main advantage of the BFI set is it has a lot of his very early short films, has supplements, which is something that the Shout Factory set doesn't really cover very much. And it also has some other sort of films from later on that in the Shout Factory set that aren't covered by BFI. And one of the films, his early films, Even Dwarf Started Small, isn't included in the BFI set. I would assume that is partly due to some of the animal, you know, there is some scenes of kind of animal violence and you know, some sort of unpleasant scenes with involving animals that here in the UK there are some fairly strict laws about, and quite rightly too, about animal cruelty and about the depicting images of animals suffering and things like that. So I suspect that might be one of the reasons why that particular film wasn't included in the BFI set.
Well, yeah, I do want to maybe touch on Even Dwarf Started Small. Maybe we can come back to that towards the end of our conversation, because I guess I want to keep the main focus on the episode here, Fata Morgana.
Fata Morgana was actually filmed, even though it came out afterwards, sort of chronologically in terms of release, it was actually filmed before Even Dwarf Started Small.
Okay.
And I think some of his experiences making the first film actually had quite a bit of impact on the second. So it's probably more appropriate to speak about it kind of as an afterthought, really.
That's very helpful for me to know. So let's just talk a little bit about Fata Morgana then. Let's get right to it. This is a film that's really... It feels like it's kind of a cobbled together salvage job, which I'll just say right here, I enjoyed this film more than Even Dwarf Started Small. But again,
absolutely, I would agree with that. Yeah.
but what surprises me to hear that this was actually filmed prior to Even Dwarf Started Small is I'm just wondering, how did he fall into this particular project? I guess the setup here is that this is a lot of color footage that was shot in various locations in Africa. In the beginning is primarily, I think, in like southern Algeria, or at least on part of Algeria that is, you know, pretty much, you know, if not right on the border, but pretty well within the realm of the Sahara Desert. And that's where the idea of Mirage comes in, or Fata Morgana. The opening scenes are actually of a series of jetliners landing, but because of the deep focus and the optical illusion of sorts of these jets landing on a hot tarmac and runway, it doesn't feel like the planes are coming at you. It feels like they're just descending, you know. There's maybe a slight enlargement, but must be they're kind of filming from quite a distance. And there's all this kind of warping and blurring of the image. Yeah, distortion, right, these large objects and seeing them kind of in quick succession like that. It has this kind of otherworldly feel to it. And then other scenes are, you know, again, long tracking shots in the desert and these kind of very weird, surreal landscapes. And my understanding is that this was originally intended to be part of some kind of a science fiction scenario, that these desert dunes and wastelands would be kind of the alien landscape as the backdrop of this story, but that sort of fell apart. So what more can you add, if, or correct me if I'm mistaken on any of this, but what is your understanding of the circumstances of how this footage came to be taken at first?
Well, I guess from reading just this week as part of my kind of preparations for our conversation this weekend, I managed to find my copy of Herzog on Herzog, which is an older book that contains a lot of interviews with him done over a period of time, and where he talks a lot about the kind of genesis of a lot of his films. And my understanding from reading that is that the project came about basically because he won a prize. His very first feature film was called Signs of Life, which I don't believe is included in either of the sets that we talked about, unfortunately. But it's a story set during the Second World War. I've never seen it myself. I've never had an opportunity, but I would love to see it one day. It was his first feature film, and it won some sort of an award in Germany. And part of the prize for winning this award was an amount of money that was given in order to invest in their next feature film project or their next film project. So in true Herzog style, what he did was he took this prize money, and instead of making one film, he decided to make three films with the money. And so what he did was him and his cinematographer and a couple of other sort of technical people just basically lived very rough, living in cars and living on the streets, basically, while they traveled across Europe and into Africa. With the intention of filming, like you said, this science fiction story. And the main premise of the film originally, I guess, was, and which explains a lot about the sort of otherworldly quality of it, is that the premise was that some aliens came down to Earth or it wasn't even necessarily meant to be Earth, but just some planet. And they were basically just taking some pictures and looking around and getting a feel for this place that they're visiting. And then the idea was that the film would be like essentially like a kind of a Blair Witch sort of thing, where it would be a found footage scenario where some humans would then find this alien footage and then try to piece it together to get an idea of how the aliens perceived Earth. So that was the basic premise of the film. But as they began their travels across Africa, and specifically across the Sahara, at a certain point, Herzog just decided to abandon that storyline altogether, because he became totally fascinated with the mirages that he saw in the desert, because he would see these incredible images out on the horizon, this kind of effect of the sun and the reflection off of various things. And he just became totally fascinated by these things, and he decided that he just wanted to document these images. So he began to film a lot of these occurrences, and then also a lot of the sort of landscapes and different things that he saw along the way. And then after he came back with all this footage, then he somehow sat down and said, well, I've got all this stuff now, what am I going to do with it, basically? Yeah. And so then he just fashioned this piece together by taking all these different images and all these different things that he saw, and he kind of pieced it together. And I mean, there is, I don't know, there isn't really a narrative per se, but there is a sort of an overall structure in the fact that he's broken it up into three sections. And he's kind of based it partly on the sort of Mayan creation myth or the old sort of mythology called, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it properly, but it's a Popol Vuh, Popol Vuh.
Yeah, that's what I would go with.
Yeah, my apologies to your listeners because my pronunciations is probably not the best. But but he basically based it around this premise using this narration and then cutting these images together. And he creates just this really sort of otherworldly, sort of very impressionistic view of the African landscape. And what you get, like you said, is just these very sort of barren, because the things he tends to concentrate on aren't the normal things that you would necessarily see in like a National Geographic documentary or, you know, some sort of normal travelogue. It's instead he concentrates on this barren sort of wastelands and these weird shapes and these mirages. And there's a lot of signs. When you do see signs of civilization, it's like there are things like wrecks, old plane wrecks and old car wrecks and things in the desert, and these kind of weird man-made structures like old oil refineries and weird things that all look like they're abandoned and decrepit and falling apart. And there's a lot of decay and things like that you see. And these are the things that he chose to focus on. So it makes for some quite fascinating imagery.
And much of it is really aesthetically very beautiful, and there is this obviously very improvised nature to so much of it. Even the post shoot editing that they did, the imposition of this text and this structure, it feels pretty arbitrary. And I would suppose if you're not in a particularly charitable mood, you could just say this is a bit of a wank fest or a bit of excessive self-indulgence, because by pairing this footage with this ancient creation myth, this kind of Mayan thing, which was, I think, kind of in vogue. I mean, there was a fairly successful German progressive rock band that took the name Popol Vuh and actually did some collaborations with Herzog later in that decade. So this is the same time as bands like Genesis and Can and maybe even early Kraftwerk. You know, there was a lot of experimentation going on. The Soft Machine, they were not just traditional rock bands, but they were, you know, kind of experimenting and incorporating jazz and classical influences as well as, you know, pop and rock sensibilities. But just the fact that, you know, Herzog was quoting the Popol Vuh and there was a kind of a progressive band kind of coming together using that same name shows me there's a little bit of trendiness or a dabbling in these other cultures here. But I think he also wanted to touch base with and draw our attention to something very primitive and primordial, because you know, there are also, besides the wreckage and the, you know, the kind of decay images, there's also scenes of very ordinary, very close to the earth, you know, people, inhabitants of this desert region, men who are, you know, digging with shovels into some kind of I don't know if it's some kind of chalk or mineral type of a thing and pounding it out and refining
lime.
So these are very, you know, very gut level, you know, people eking out their survival in very harsh conditions, even children running around, you know, born into this very hostile landscape and doing what they can to survive. So I think there's an ironic aspect to how these creation texts are used, because there's the creation, then there's this age of paradise, and then there's the golden age, which kind of in the conventional mythic structure, that's kind of how these things go. There's an initial act of creation, there's a state of perfection, and then after some kind of a fall or some kind of expulsion from paradise, there's still a golden age of heroes and those who were, you know, kind of closest to the source, And then, of course, that brings us to our contemporary current times, where the Golden Age is a far-flung memory, but it's still something to be looked back with reverence and awe. And yet, the scenery that he uses, that he juxtaposes with these readings, whether it's the lushness of creation and paradise or the, you know, heroics of the Golden Age, it's kind of humorous when you see what's on screen versus the words that are being spoken at that moment.
Yeah, there is definitely a great sense of irony, and sort of he tends to focus on things to show almost the absurdity of kind of the civilization. And also the way that he films people, quite often it isn't, you know, quite often he'll have people that are sort of just standing quite still and just holding things up into the camera, but not moving, not speaking.
Or posing with their arms in kind of a, you know, kind of a strained posture, flexing muscles, or pointing at some obscure object on the ground. Yeah.
Yeah, and a lot of those things fall back into that idea of, like, if it was like the original concept of the piece, that these aliens had come down to look at Earth and they were just sort of looking at these specimens before them. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the way the camera treats these people. And you don't hear any, you know, at least in the first creation section of the film, there isn't any natural direct sound or an ambient sound that you hear in the film. It's all just this carefully sort of atmospheric or moody kind of music that's in the background. So it really does create this kind of otherworldly effect. It kind of takes you outside of the idea that you're on Earth and that these are a familiar landscape, but instead you're looking at things with this kind of completely new perspective. And I think that's a theme that runs through a lot of Herzog's films, especially the early ones, where you always see a slightly skewed perspective on things. You look at things in a way that you wouldn't normally perceive them. So that's, I think, one of the things that makes the film really interesting to watch, because you're always kind of picking out these things, and there's this strangeness and otherworldliness to it. But then if you take a step back and you say, well, actually, this is Earth, and this is our place, this is our, you know, these are people, you know, normal people here going about their daily business. But there's a kind of an otherworldly quality to it, or at least I find anyway.
Yeah, I think there's a couple things. There's kind of this meta quality where he's, because these tracking shots go on for so long, and they're, I mean, even if you're just looking at the film as some kind of, you know, visual wallpaper and checking out sort of the exotic locations, there is just no narrative. The tracking shots go on without really much editing, and even the sequencing can sometimes feel a little bit random. So you're constantly being reminded that you're watching a film here. It's an unusual film, and yet there are moments of true beauty, and these landscapes are not familiar. This is not, you know, John Ford out west in Monument Valley. These are places that you've maybe never seen. And as you say, David, there's a skewed perspective. So even if you've seen desert landscapes in those, you know, proverbial National Geographic videos or other, you know, Disney type of documentaries, The World of Nature or whatever, there is something that feels very alien and foreboding about this. And even though he's showing ordinary people, you know, salt of the earth types going about their daily business, I think Herzog understands that most of the people likely to view this film have not encountered people like those that he's got on screen. And likewise, the people on screen, you know, the world of art house cinema and the cultural avant-garde is like a whole nother planet and civilization away. And so he's sort of bringing two distant branches of the human family, at least our side of it, the cinema enthusiast side, where maybe encountering fellow humans that really had been off of our radar. You know, we don't really think about who these people are living in these really sparse and you know, very, very kind of deprived conditions. out in this desert. It just feels so incredibly hostile, you know, to have to eke out a living in these circumstances, and yet there they are. So yeah, there's kind of a playfulness, but it's kind of got a grim wit to it as well.
Yeah, it's quite interesting the way that he, because he's sectioned the film into these three distinct sections. And the first section, initially, you don't really see people very much for the first little while. And at first, the first kind of images that you get, they might not even be people. They're these mirages, and they're it's this sort of distorted images, and in the background you can sort of see figures moving around, but you're not quite sure what they are. Sometimes it looks like it might be a person, or it might be somebody on horseback, or it might be a car, or it might be, you know, something else, and you can never quite tell. And they're always just these really indistinct sort of strange images that are kind of floating off in the distance. And then gradually, as the film progresses, then you start to actually see more distinct people. But there's maybe just one, and they're just walking quite far in the distance. And then gradually you begin to move in, you see a few more people, and then you see a group of children sort of, but they all look quite scared, and like they're kind of looking at the camera like, you know, what's going on? What is this? And they're kind of run, some of them are running away. And there is this kind of, you know, real sort of weird sense as people are introduced into the landscape, and when we begin to focus on them, it is really just like you've started to focus in on these specimens that have just kind of emerged from this strange landscape that we've slowly been going through as the film progresses.
Yeah, and then there's also, you know, sections where it just feels like Herzog found something amusing in some of the different individuals. What'd you think of the guy who, I don't know if he's a monitor hunter or trapper, but he has this big lizard, and
Yes.
it's a pretty impressive specimen itself.
He does, and he has this great big sort of gaping, bleeding wound on his hand because apparently the thing bit him as they were filming, and there's flies kind of gathering on it, and he's quite enthusiastically talking about his. You know, he says a strange thing too, which is really striking. He kind of goes, "I only have 16 years left to learn about these things and to understand them."
And he's been out there
So,
for what, 12 or so that he said? So he must, is he on
yeah.
some kind of a term plan, a 28-year plan or
I don't
something?
know. Maybe in 16 years is when his grant runs out. I
Or
don't
is forced into retirement and has to go back home or something. But it
know.
is,
Yeah,
it's
maybe.
very fascinating. And he talks just a little bit about how arduous it is to track these lizards down, how they hide in burrows. And I mean, he's kind of building his own little legend, I suppose. But it is pretty fascinating, and you wonder what drives a man to want to accomplish this. I mean, it is fascinating to have this monitor, but I don't know that I could see myself justifying that kind of labor and discomfort. But you know, I guess that's what keeps me a sort of a common ordinary householder versus this man of adventure who's out there doing amazing things in the forbidding wilderness like that.
Well, to hear about some of the experiences that Herzog had when making the film, I think I'm quite happy just to watch it at home, to be fair.
The
It's
Algerian military base as well. I mean, those are some of those long tracking shots where, you know, there's barbed wire, and on the other side there's, you know, different kind of facilities, maybe you know, warehouses or armories, you know, weapon stockpiles, the kind of thing where if you're caught by the wrong people shooting this film, they're not going to really, you know, honor your civil rights, and give you a fair trial. They might take care of business right then and there. So, there's kind of a recklessness to all that, yeah.
Apparently that is again essentially what happened is that at a certain point they were arrested because apparently the cinematographer that sorry I didn't write his name down here so I don't know it off the top of my head but His name apparently was quite similar to a German mercenary that had been taken part in a failed coup in Cameroon around the time that they were filming. And so what ultimately happened is that they were all arrested and thrown in prison.
Yeah.
And apparently it's interesting when you listen to the commentary track on the video or read some of his recollections. Apparently they were treated very, very harshly in this prison. And oddly, it must have been quite bad because he didn't want to elaborate very much on what actually happened. He just said, like, we were treated very, very badly. And this experience had quite a profound effect on him, as you can imagine.
But not such to dissuade him from, you know, future feats of heroic filmmaking of where his own well-being, and not just his own personal, but the lives and health and sanity of his crew and cast were pressed to the limit. I mean, he really did seem to have this go-for-the-throat mentality from a very early age, and that seems to have persisted. I imagine it's fair to say maybe he's mellowed out some in more recent years or decades, but throughout the 1970s, we're going to see him repeatedly throwing himself right into the jaws of peril and hardship for the sake of pursuing his art. And so you see that this isn't just sort of a publicity stunt or some kind of a way of gaining cheap notoriety. There was a real earnest sincerity to this pursuit of getting footage that was really unique, because the circumstances that it took to get that camera in that place was just so arduous that most, more cautious and you might even say sane filmmakers would say it ain't worth it. Well, Herzog went there.
Well, yeah, I guess I suppose it's very much this idea that once you've gone through so much, you can't kind of give up now, sort of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, there might be an element of that to it, which, you know, I can understand. But it's quite interesting when you listen to Werner Herzog speak, or when you read some of the things he's written, he really does have this kind of, he's such an interesting person because he kind of really does kind of almost believe like it's his destiny to do these things, and that he's kind of almost compelled by a higher sort of calling that he must do these things, and they must happen. And he even relates a story at one point that he claims he grew up in a kind of a small village in Bavaria, and he claims that he never even heard of films or seen any films until he was 12 years old. And then one day when he was about 14, he was out walking out in the wilderness or something. And he one day literally just had this kind of euphoric enlightened moment where he just decided that he was going to be a filmmaker and he had to make films. And this was his kind of destiny to do it. Mm-hmm. So it's quite an interesting sort of, the way that he sort of approaches things is kind of like that. He kind of, you know, this, I must do this. Mm-hmm. I'm compelled to do this and it must happen. So no matter what, I'm going to see this through. And it's quite obviously an interesting, you know, in some ways admirable. And like you say, in other ways, sometimes it can also be, harmful as well. And then if you're dragging other people along for you on this kind of quest.
He has a certain grandiosity about him, which I think because he has such interesting artifacts, the films that he's left behind him, several of which you've already mentioned and will be, you know, part of the queue here on the episodes in seasons to come, as well as The Land of Silence and Darkness, which we'll be covering a little further down the road. This is another 1971 documentary. Yeah.
Land of Silence and Darkness is one of my absolute favorite films of his. I think it's such a such an amazing film. But obviously, we're not here to talk about that today.
Yeah, no, we'll get to that. So, and I haven't watched it yet, but I'm excited I think our plan is for you to rejoin me for that one. And we'll get another voice or two on there as well. We'll see how that all unfolds. But, you know, the fact is his grandiosity, his larger-than-life personality, the sort of self-cultivation of a myth that I think is, you know, it's a significant part of what's, you know, garnered his following and maybe even his ability to finance and fund his films. I mean, I don't know that he's ever done much. Maybe Grizzly Man, a fairly recent film of his, might have been his biggest commercial success just because of the sensational subject matter. But he's never been a commercial director. He's never been a guy who's like, okay, I'm going to take a studio job and make a conventional type of story so that I can get money to film the stuff I really want to do. He has done what he really wanted to do all
the way. And he seems there was a certain... Oh, sorry, David, if I cut over you there.
Yeah.
But he seemed to definitely gravitate more and concentrate more after kind of the 80s and sort of Fitzcarraldo. I think he tended to concentrate more on documentary films exclusively for quite a long time.
Yeah.
So that might be one of the reasons why he kind of sort of commercially maybe went off the radar a little bit for maybe a decade or so until Grizzly Man. Mm-hmm. But to me, I think his greatest strength has been his documentaries. I think mm-hmm. He's made some of the most fascinating films that, you know, that I've ever seen. And they're always the sort of documentaries and things more than his sort of fictional sort of dramatic films. Mm-hmm. I don't think he ever really had any major sort of commercial success aside from maybe Aguirre and maybe Nosferatu.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I don't think Fitzcarraldo was a major sort of commercial success. And I think after that, he found it much more difficult to get the financing and to get projects together. And he tended to be tied quite very much to Klaus Kinski, that mm-hmm. apparently neither of them, they went through a period where neither of them could really work without the other. So there was a lot of bitterness and things that developed over that.
Well, it seems like, again, the way Herzog has lived his life, the stories and the personalities that he's drawn to, and even this sense of a destiny, a commission to be a filmmaker, it's like he's trying to capture these extraordinary people. He's a filmmaker, he's a documentarian, but the people that he's trying to capture on film really are not that type of person. They're people out living extraordinary lives, whether they're fictional characters or whether they're actual people or some kind of hybrid, you know. He seems to really want to capture, depict, and maybe even advocate for this live life by the seat of your pants, you know, skin of your teeth, you know, clawing and grasping for what you can get, rather than the more domesticated, comfortable type of middle-class lives that, you know, for better or worse, most people either enjoy or even in some respect aspire to. He's drawn by those people who are like on the desperate, frenzied edge where disaster or even death may be just a misstep away, or the conditions of their life are so intense that, you know, even though they're not maybe living recklessly, they're still very challenged, and there's something about that scenario, that kind of situation, that I think appeals to him. And I think people who maybe live a bit of their life vicariously through cinema, and I'll count myself as one of them, find that pretty fascinating, just as subject matter, to say, wow, what it would be like to be that person or in that situation. Roger Ebert talked about cinema as the empathy machine, and I think that's a pretty key insight as to what draws us to watching movies that reflect experiences maybe very different from our own. At some point, maybe it does kind of perhaps feel a little bit exploitive or manipulative. There is kind of whether it's anti-Herzog or people who are just not fully on board, I have just never made the big plunge into Herzog's film. I did see Fitzcarraldo back in 82, back when it first came out in its original theatrical run. I loved it, but I didn't, like, draw me to just seeing everything else. I've seen Nosferatu, I've seen Aguirre, but I've never really made that sustained study of Herzog's film. But I feel like with this Shout Factory set, now with the excuse of the podcast, I'll definitely be plowing my way through his works and maybe trying to take in some of those less familiar works or not captured in the set, just to kind of understand more of the journey that he takes us on, or that he went on himself as a filmmaker.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's lots of great stuff to get sink your teeth into there. Mm-hmm. Like I sort of said at the beginning, I mean, some of his films, he's not always necessarily successful in the things that he sets out to do, I don't think. Right. It's certainly quite easy, I think, sometimes that you could find very easily ways of to criticize some of the films. But I think even when he doesn't quite hit the mark, I think there's always something really interesting and absorbing about the films that draws you in. Mm-hmm. Certainly some of his, I would definitely recommend people check out Little Dieter Needs to Fly, which is a really great documentary about someone who's put in a very extreme situation and how they cope with it. And the way that he tells the story is very interesting. Sort of a fictionalized version of the film later on with Christian Bale, which I can't remember the name of it now, but I absolutely hated it, and I think it doesn't work at all.
Okay.
And it was a really unfortunate thing, because the documentary and the way that he told the story there with the actual man and his choice of the style that he chose to tell the story is really effective and really interesting and quite harrowing and emotional. And then when he tried to fictionalize it I'm using the term fictionalize, but mm-hmm. when he tried to dramatize it is what I meant to say, and make a dramatic feature out of the same material, it just completely falls flat and is really sort of doesn't work at all. Mm. So I think that is where, like, something like Fata Morgana, to come back to that, is where his real strength lies, in just taking a camera and just capturing moments kind of on the spur of the moment, quite spontaneously. When he sees things that are interesting, he just finds a really unique perspective and a way of capturing that on film and making you see something slightly differently than you would before.
Yeah, and I love many of those moments. There's that boy holding that little dog fox thing, and honestly, it looks to me like he's holding a Pokemon or something like that. You know?
Yeah, it is very strange, because the animal doesn't move, does it? It just sits there, like,
right, and he's holding
totally
by
transfixed.
The neck, like the whole body being suspended from the boy's fingers right around his neck, and he's just like sitting there, sort of passively taking it. But it's like, what is that animal even? I mean, I've seen a lot of animal films and nature documentaries. I've never seen anything that quite looks like that. It's extremely cute and adorable. I can see why that boy would show it off as a point of pride that he possesses this little creature. And then there's that kind of very dignified, elderly African man. He's got those little medals on his tunic there. And this kind of woman with a little kind of proto boombox that she's walking around with music, and it's just, who are these people, and what an interesting situation that they find themselves in, and Herzog's, you know, just creating these visual impressions where, so I think all these little assorted parts, you know, he does a serviceable job of weaving them into some kind of a narrative. I can't say that if you're a scholar of the Popol Vuh, or you're trying to understand Mayan mythology, that this film is going to give you any kind of unique insight into that. But he's just putting these elements together in ways that are striking, even if they don't exactly mesh into something that Oh, this is a brilliant synthesis here. You go ahead and take your thought there.
Well, interestingly, about the Popol Vuh, they did apparently only the first section, the creation section, is where he based the narration on that. And even that isn't, it's not any kind of verbatim reciting of that text. He actually adapted it and kind of wrote it
Paraphrased,
himself.
yes.
Yeah. So it's basically not even that is sort of specifically from that text. And then in the second and third sections, Paradise and the Golden Age, all the narration he just wrote himself. They aren't based on the Popol Vuh at all.
Okay,
They're
so it's just kind of his
literally.
own sort of
Yeah, and you can tell too
speculation,
that
or
he wrote a lot of it based on, obviously he'd already edited or maybe roughly put things together, and then he wrote this narration that kind of in some ways gels with the images that you're seeing. So they although they are still very kind of abstract and very, very interesting. Some of them I wrote down just ones that were really interesting because he says things like there is a landscape even without deeper meaning. And he says that several times throughout the second section in Paradise. So, and you just think, well, what does that mean? He's basically implying that what there is no meaning here, or, I don't know. And he repeats it several times. And,
Yeah, I mean, this is just it's just a place. I mean, it is foreign, it is exotic, it is foreboding and kind of hostile to eyes that are not used to seeing these types of scenes or going back to that note of empathy, boy, how would we fear if we had to live in these huts or without so many of the comforts that we're used to? But I don't think he's trying to make us feel some sort of sadness or sympathy or admiration for these people. He's just sort of saying these are other people. They're not more noble or blessed or enlightened than anybody else. They're just humans who happen to be found in this part of the world, so check them out for what they are. But I think he has a respect for them. I don't know. It is kind of interesting. And then in the Paradise section, there's that other couple, the drummer and the male drummer, the woman playing the piano. And that seemed to me a little, there's a little bit of a mocking tone to that. Maybe it's just my own read of this music. What was your take on that section there, especially putting it in the context of this so-called golden age?
Well, yeah, the structure of the film's quite interesting because the first section, creation, is, as we talked about, it's like these kind of very strange otherworldly images, and the music is, he uses a little bit of Mozart's, I think it's the Coronation Mass, but I could never, like, I can't find any sort of anywhere where it's documented about the specific music or the specific recordings that he used. But in that first section, he mainly uses the Coronation Mass. I think that's what it is. And then, and it creates this really sort of stark otherworldly effect, and that whole section runs like that, and we don't start to see people till kind of more the end of that section. Then in the Paradise section, it is that title can be taken as more ironic because a lot of the images and things you see, as you say, are people who are, I don't think you would necessarily, certainly from our Western sort of comfortable Western affluent lifestyles, we wouldn't describe these conditions as being paradise. We see these are people who are on the very lowest end of the kind of economic, ladder, and they're living in quite sort of, very basic conditions, and they're working, like you say, in the limestone pits and things like that, where it's obviously not very nice. So the term using that, describing that as paradise, you can interpret as being a little bit more ironic, and maybe it is a little bit sad or a little bit absurd. Like you see all these images of decay and people living in sort of broken down buildings
and of cattle and
some really sort of strange images of decaying animals and things like that. And then when you move into the third section, the Golden Age, where you were talking about, like that that couple who were playing the music in the dance hall or wherever it is, that third section then moves from this kind of otherworldly or sort of strange sort of ambience to more directly, it's kind of overtly absurd, and even some of the people that we see, obviously the things have been staged to a certain extent. They he's obviously got taken people and told them to do these things, or he's putting sort of strange combinations of people together.
You don't feel like you're in Africa anymore. I mean, this back in Europe somewhere, or were these people who maybe did live in Africa but maybe in a more urban setting or a more colonial or post-colonial type of situation? There's no context. In fact, you talk about a music hall, you really don't know where they are. All you see is the kind of straight shot of them on the stage with some lights and decorations around them, but you don't know who their audience that they're performing for is. There's a little bit of a kind of a fence with ropes between them and the audience, which is kind of an unusual, prop for the front of a stage for a performance place.
The audio's really distorted again, and you can't really understand what he's singing.
I wasn't sure if those were lyrics or if he's just doing some blah, 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 scat singing,
Well, I would say that, David, like, if you listen to the audio commentary, he does explain who these people are and where he did. But I think for the benefit of people who haven't seen the film before, it's probably better not to explain these things too much, because I think the first time, at least the first time that you see the film, I would imagine that the best way to experience it is to go into it completely without any preconceptions or without any real knowledge about what you're seeing, because then it has that effect on you of, of you being sucked into the oddness and where it's open to interpretation, and you can project whatever you want onto it rather than having a clear understanding about exactly what you're seeing. Because I think to a certain extent, that might almost spoil it.
I did listen to some of the commentary track, but I never finished it. And I'm just as glad. Maybe I'll go back to that myself, having concluded the episode. Because there's kind of this weird mystery to how did we get from there to here as we're watching this,
And it is interesting that that third section it almost kind of stylistically it is separate from the first two, in that it is more, like I said, more sort of deliberately staged. And some of the, apparently not all of it was, but a lot of it is, they were the specific images that you see were set up. He had people there and he asked them to do things and then he filmed them. And it does have a much more of an absurd or comic feel to it. And it almost sort of sits at odds with the rest of the film in that sense, because stylistically it doesn't quite sit with the rest of it in the same way. But it's still, if you take the original premise and the idea that, like, if this was aliens come down with a video camera or a film camera or whatever, and they were, just capturing just random images of what they saw while they were visiting this strange place, then it kind of does fit in sort of with these kind of, these kind of weird phenomena that you are seeing. So it does kind of fit in, but at the same time, it has a completely different feel to it than the rest of the film, I think.
Yeah, and there's a startling aspect. I mean, the guy with the sea turtle in his wetsuit. What? And you've got the kind of the African call and response gospel choir, and just really, really fascinating. And again,
yeah, and those moments, people coming out of the holes as well, which is just a really weird, you just have these random people, and some of them are children and some of them are grown-ups, and they clearly look like they're kind of Western, you know, they're white people,
tourists.
And they're dressed in sort of normal Western clothes, and they're just kind of coming up out of these holes in the ground, and they're just sort of waving their arms about and behaving in a really odd way, and you know, it's, you know, you're just going, what is this? What is going on here?
They're very clearly mugging for the camera, you know, like there's somebody directing and saying, okay, be weird, you know. It's kind of like group selfies where we'll take our smiling pretty shot and then our sticking our tongue out and rolling our eyes and waving our arms shot. Well, this is the goofy shot. And it's at this point you're either on board with it or you're not, you know. If you're looking for some kind of proto Koyaanisqatsi, this isn't really it. I can see some similarities, you know.
Is it all right, David, if I just go back to that opening, the very opening of the film, because it's quite an interesting thing. And I remember the very first time I saw this film was many, many years ago back in Toronto. I saw it at the I'm pained to remember the exact name of it now, but it's like the Ontario Cinematheque or something, when they, you know, it's kind of like the BFI and the NFT we have here in London, but they, you know, it's just like a repertory sort of art house kind of film place. I don't know if it's still there or whatever, but anyway, I saw this film many years ago when I was probably maybe 21 or something like that, just quite young. And I remember sitting down, I saw it in a screening in the cinema, and that initial thing with the airplanes coming in is quite, you know, you really don't know what's going on when the film starts and you get these kind of repeated images of these planes coming in. And obviously when I was younger and probably a little less patient with these sorts of these types of films, I was, you know, my initial reaction was just like anyone else would be, you know, what the hell's going on here? What is this? But what's really interesting about that, those planes coming in, is that as each time they come in, because he filmed those in sequence, and during the day as it got hotter, and the more the effects of the heat coming off of the sort of the landing, you know, the runway, the images gradually become more and more distorted. And obviously there's different planes coming in, and some of them kind of wobble a bit, and some of them come in nice and smooth, and some of them are big and some of them are a bit smaller. But the combined effect of that is that kind of takes you in to this world that you're going into, because you've got these planes that kind of come in one after the other, and they gradually become more and more distorted and more sort of, you know, you can start to see the trees in the background are moving in the wind, and they're kind of undulating, and there's all this sort of the heat distorting the background, and the planes start to almost take on, like me personally, I just would almost see like faces in the front of the planes, you know, because of the cockpit and the little lights flashing. And it almost looks like at sort of the last couple that come in, it almost does look like almost like a creature, some sort of sort of giant bird or something coming in. You know, it's just this really strange gradual effect that it has. And then it immediately then sort of cuts to these amazing landscapes, these kind of giant sand dunes with the wind blowing and everything. And I think it is a really effective opening, because it really sort of brings you gradually in, because at first you see a quite familiar image, but then as it kind of keeps repeating, it gradually becomes more distorted and more otherworldly. And then it takes you into these images of landscapes and stuff, which is, I just think is quite an interesting thing.
Yeah.
And Herzog said that he did include that in as a test for the audience, basically, which is quite interesting, because when I think back at my initial reaction, because, certainly most people who are more accustomed to you know, more sort of commercial films and things would be challenged by that opening, because it goes on for like a good sort of, you know, 6, 7, 8 minutes or something, of these planes just repeatedly coming in on a on a landing strip, and you kind of don't know what's going on and what to expect. So it has just a really strange effect. What did you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, I feel like this isn't some kind of, you know, artsy prologue. I mean, you know, I'm really not comparing these films. I'm certainly not trying to say anything negative, but like Persona, let's say, you know, Ingmar Bergman's film, you know, it's got this kind of prologue section where it's high art and powerful images without a whole lot of narrative, you know, explanation of what's going on. I mean, even after Bergman's prologue is done in Persona, now we're getting into a story, you know, and it's brilliant and all of that. Here, you just don't get that satisfaction of this is how it all fits together. And it's because, you know, Herzog was not working from a grand plan. You know, he did not have a prefigured scheme that he was pursuing, that even if he, you know, veered from it a little bit here or there, he kind of knew where this was going to wind up. So in a sense, he had a lot of really fascinating footage, and he structured it in a way that, you know, holds together to a certain extent, although I'm sure not to the satisfaction of a lot of viewers who would just kind of shrug it off and say, what was that all about? But one thing I did want to mention is, and get your thoughts on as well, is there are some points of contact with his soundtrack music. You've mentioned some of the classical Handel and Bach and others, but there's very direct use of Leonard Cohen, which we talked about Leonard Cohen when we did our episode on McCabe and Mrs. Miller a couple months ago. And here, lo and behold, from the very same album, the Songs of Leonard Cohen, which was his first, there are three songs selected. And interestingly enough, again, no overlap with the three songs that were selected from that album for McCabe and Mrs. Miller, as well as, I guess, Blind Faith. And there's another English band called the Third Ear Band that were on the soundtracks. I didn't recognize the Blind Faith track. I mean, they've got a few pretty well-known songs, but I didn't know which one was theirs. But what did you think about the use of the Western pop/rock music as part of the soundtrack here?
Well, I must admit, like, probably if I had any criticism of the film at all, it might be the use of the Leonard Cohen tracks, and not because I have, because I love Leonard Cohen. And it's nothing against his music at all, but I think in the context where he uses it, because I think for me the problem was just the lyrics, because up to that point the film very much uses sort of instrumental music, and it has, like I said, there isn't any natural sound or direct sound from the environments we're seeing. It's all just this music that creates a certain feel and a certain atmosphere. And I guess the problem for me with about song lyrics is that obviously a song lyric has a specific meaning. Although Leonard Cohen's music, obviously you can interpret his lyrics in a number of ways, I guess. But I guess for me, if anything, the use of music with song lyrics, with somebody singing, kind of slightly takes you out of that kind of feeling that the film had up till that point. And you don't, and necessarily the things that Leonard Cohen are singing about in that don't necessarily fit in with some of the images you're seeing. So I guess if I was going to criticize the film at all, because I think this is kind of the kind of film that, in a sense, is sort of beyond criticism, in a sense, because it is so much what the viewer brings to it. It is a film that's completely open to your own personal interpretation or your own, the way that you choose to take it or be open to it or close to it or whatever you choose to be. So I think it's very difficult to say it's a good film or a bad film or a successful film on that level. It's just kind of there, and you just experience it the way you experience it. But I think that the Leonard Cohen bits are the bits, you know, I guess musically, I think he probably just chose the music because of the feeling of it, you know, because maybe they sounded a bit sad or a bit, you know, had a certain feel for it. And maybe he wasn't really taking the lyrics into account. But I think they do sort of slightly take me out of the film a little bit.
Yeah, I think that the two songs in particular, Suzanne, which really early on, it's a wonderful song. I love that song, but it had already become kind of a standard. I mean, you know, Tony Bennett and Frank Sinatra were probably covering it by this point, and it's such a sort of a low key pop classic in its own terms that. It feels pretty distracting. And then the other one, So Long Marianne, with its kind of sing-song chorus, again, a great kind of hooky tune, but it didn't feel like it, you know, and I appreciate some of the irony and some of the subversive juxtapositions between word and image, or even some of the, you know, the sacred music or the classical, more ethereal feeling styles of music, That is very atmospheric, but I pretty much agree with your take there. The sound of the songs, you know, fits the other one. That's No Way to Say I Love You or something like that. That's No Way to Say Goodbye. That one felt okay to me, but it was just it perhaps opens the film to a little bit more criticism of just kind of random drops. He just kind of, you know, spliced things together and said, there it is, which is probably true in some respects. But as you say, it's an object to be contemplated. It's not really trying to accomplish a certain thing that, you know, opens us to a verdict of whether or not it achieved what it set out to do. So it exists. And I think that's at this point, especially in Herzog's early career, that's plenty.
Yeah, I think the use of music too, like because the early part of the film is all just these images and these kind of landscapes and things, and then gradually as we start to see more images of civilization or the remnants of civilizations and things, that's when the music changes to become more sort of the more popular music or sort of more contemporary music, or at least contemporary when it was made. So maybe that was all it was, that initially the sort of the early bits he used more sort of atmospheric sort of classical music that had a certain feel and a certain vibe to it that went with those images. And then as we start to see buildings and this first people wandering around in the background and stuff, then the music begins to change to more contemporary sort of sounds and, you know, acoustic guitars and some electric guitars and things like that. So maybe he was, you know, maybe that was all it was, that he was just using more modern sounding music for those images.
Returning us back to the world that most viewers are familiar with. That seems fair enough. Any final thoughts or any other kind of bits of the film that you wanted to make sure we had a chance to talk about before we start wrapping things up?
Well, I guess, no, I think we've pretty much covered it. I mean, I think it's, I guess as a final thought, I would just say to people, just please watch this film. It's great. I think it's an amazing film. It is, I think from his early set of films, very earliest set of films anyway, it is definitely the most interesting and the most, I mean, it says a lot that just this week, something I never do is I don't tend to sort of binge watch things, and I don't tend to watch films over and over again within a short space of time. But this week, because I knew I was going to be having this conversation with you, I've actually watched the film about three times.
Yeah.
Once with the commentary track, but just a couple times I just watched it. And I would say every time you watch it, it is still totally fascinating and totally absorbing, and you end up seeing different things in it, and you notice different things. I mean, sorry if I just go over one more bit that I want to mention that I think is really cool, is there's some scenes, it's kind of earlier in the film, where you see these landscapes, and in the background you can kind of see these pink flamingos. I think they're flamingos, but what's interesting is that, again, in terms of the perspective, he doesn't focus on that. And normally most filmmakers or most cinematographers, if they were in that situation, these huge undulating masses of birds, thousands of birds all flocking and flying up and taking off and all that would be the thing that they would focus on in that situation. But instead, for us, when we watch the film, you just see them kind of in the background, and you can kind of tell they're there, but you can't always necessarily tell what they are, and you might have to look a bit closely to go, what are they? And he doesn't focus on that. So instead, it just becomes these shapes and this kind of undulating mass that's kind of happening off in the distance in the background. And I just think things like that are really fascinating. And one of the things that I like about Werner Herzog is his films. He does that. He doesn't focus on the obvious thing, where he always kind of pinpoints something that's a little bit of a different perspective than you would expect. And he makes you see things in a different way. He makes you notice things that you wouldn't necessarily notice.
Yeah, no, he's a true visionary, and I think that's what makes me very excited to be doing this more sustained and rigorous exploration of his career, especially these early years. Maybe just a real quick summary. I've already alluded, I didn't really enjoy even Dwarf Started Small. Maybe it was just a mood, place, and time. I watched it actually on Labor Day this past Monday, just because I knew I wanted to kind of get that one in as a backdrop to this film. I didn't know that it was actually filmed after Fata Morgana, but boy, I was really irritated with that movie. and I know that reviews I've read on Letterboxd, including people who I'm friends with and who I respect, really, really seem to dig it. So I can imagine maybe seeing it in a theater with a bunch of people who are on board with it. I do understand the anarchy and the kind of wildness of it all. It's about a bunch of little people, literally dwarfs, and there's kind of this kind of going crazy, berserk aspect to it. But to me, it felt very contrived. Like, whereas with Fata Morgana, I felt like these are real people, how they really live. Mm. I didn't buy that even Dwarf Started Small reflected that. And it was borderline exploitive, even though I'm sure the crew or the cast of this film looked like they were having a lot of fun, you know, kind of popping off like that. It just didn't sit well with me at the time. So, I'm 50-50 so far on that, but I'd consider giving it another shot somewhere down the road.
Well, I think, even Dwarf Started Small, I will freely admit it's probably not one of my favorites of his either. I probably take a little bit more of a, because I can understand what you're saying about the exploitative aspect of it. And I think there was a lot of criticism of the film at the time when it originally came out about that. And I don't know, I guess I can see both sides of it. I don't think that the because the entire cast of the film, I guess just for the sake of the listeners and for people who haven't seen the film, I guess we should probably describe the film just a little bit. It's basically the story of an uprising, in a sense, or some sort of a revolutionary moment. But what it is it's done in the context of this very strange, again, very much stylistically like Fata Morgana, in the sense that it's this strange kind of isolated complex of buildings. And you get the sense that the entire community are little people, or because I don't want to use any terms that are offensive to anyone nowadays, but so all the characters in the film are dwarves, and they there are certain amongst them that are kind of the leaders or the kind of the elite in this circumstance. And then what happens is that, and I'm sorry because I haven't watched it properly since a couple months ago myself, but I did watch it with the commentary track this week, just in preparation for the for this. But I guess that says a lot in the fact that I didn't actually want to sit and watch it again. But the it's basically an upright. There's some sort of a moment where the people who live in this complex and this compound decide to. I guess because some of the more senior people have gone away somewhere, and so these other people take it as their opportunity to, they decide that they don't want to conform anymore, and they don't want to live by the rules of this situation. So they basically start an uprising. And at first, it's almost playful. They start to do, you know, little naughty things and things that are, you know, they're kind of breaking the taboos and little sort of social conventions that they usually adhere to. And then gradually, as the film progresses, it just spirals out of control, and the acts become more violent, more destructive, and the people start to tear the place apart, basically. And the one person who's left there, who's kind of in charge, he's taken a hostage. So he has this other young man tied to a chair in his office, and he's basically barricaded himself in while the rest of the population in this compound just run riot and kind of start destroying the place. And I agree with you. I think the film it's not like a pleasant film to watch, really. It's quite, because it is certainly the last half of it, it does just descend into total chaos and anarchy, where they're just literally just destroying things and setting things on fire. And there's a couple of blind people who live here, and they start to taunt them and be horrible to them. And there's all these images of sort of cockfighting and chickens. You know, there's all these images cut into the film of chickens kind of pecking at each other. And, you know, and there's one sequence where there's a dead pig, but all the baby pigs are still trying to suckle at this, at the carcass of this dead, of their mother, basically. And there's a lot of really unpleasant sort of imagery like that. I guess the point that Herzog, from listening to the commentary and reading a little bit of his thoughts about the film, he still defends it as a valid film, because he claims that it was just basically came to him in a nightmare, and it was just basically him. He had a nightmare that he woke up and he was a little person, and he, you know, panicked, and that inspired him to create this kind of nightmare vision. And he kind of felt that the casting of the dwarves in the film was as a way of showing how our society and the structures of our society are out of proportion to our, you know, our ability to cope with them. So if you take him at his, you know, if you give him the benefit of the doubt that was the kind of creative vision that he had when he made the film. And it's certainly like a very, you know, it's very fascinating and film to watch, but it's kind of one of those films, like I would look at it kind of like Sallow, where you can look at it and you can sort of appreciate that it is artistically, it is a great achievement, and it has, you know, it makes some quite profound points about human society and about some of the things that we're going through. But at the same time, it's not really a pleasant thing to experience. It's not an enjoyable experience that you kind of, you know, you don't sit there on a Saturday night, you know, and kind of go, ooh, I think I'll watch Even Dwarves Start Small. You know, it's not that kind of film. It's something you go and you watch it because it is a very unique and singular kind of experience, and very, very bizarre, and very, you know, filled with just extraordinarily bizarre imagery. You know, but I'm not entirely sure it's successful in whatever point that he was really trying to make.
It's kind of a young man's kind of, you know, exercise and badassery and whatever you want to call it, punk rock, grab you by the throat, kind of, again.
Yeah, I think it is deliberately contentious, isn't it? It's very deliberately trying to, you know, be in your face and be provocative. And I think, you know, it definitely certainly is. And certainly the reaction it received, it seems like it was very provocative at the time. He did claim, because as I said, it was filmed after Fata Morgana, and all of the experiences that he had had in the desert filming, you know, getting that footage that we see in that film, he claims that a lot of that he felt at the time very bitter and very angry and very kind of upset, and he thinks that that might have had a significant influence on how the film turned out or the kind of things that we end up seeing in it. And it certainly, it does have very much of an improvisational quality to it as well. And oh, it seems that the way that they made it, they basically, he shot it in Lanzarote, and this is before it became more of a kind of a touristy sort of a settled area than it is now. So it has, in the film, it has a much more, again, very barren, it's all these kind of, all this volcanic rock and all these sort of strange landscapes that surround this compound. And the compound seems quite isolated within this, you know, and it's all filmed in black and white. So it all has this really stark and eerie sort of atmosphere to it. And sometimes the characters go off on, in little areas where they're just in these really strange kind of landscapes. And the sound, you know, they all have very high voices and things. So it has an accumulative effect of being very odd and very sort of strange film to watch. And there is a lot of really provocative images. Like there's one scene where they've tied a monkey to a crucifix, and they go marching through the square, and, you know, and they're just setting things on fire. And there's one, like a dinner scene where they have this table with spaghetti and plates and things, and they just start throwing things at each other and shouting and screaming. And so it's a really, you know, strange experience to
watch. Yeah, I like that stuff so much better when it was daisies, you know, two cute young Czech Slovak girls going crazy in the dining room.
Yeah,
I don't know. Yeah. Perhaps I discredit myself by admitting that. but I will nod respectfully for your study and scholarship and extra context. I, you know, like I say, I pretty much just watched it once straight through. Didn't go for too much further into my studies than that, other than reading the Shout Factory liner notes, which I think are at least accurate.
I would definitely recommend that you listen to the commentary. And although sure. Sometimes, again, when you talk about the exploitativeness of the, because sometimes when Werner Herzog's talking about the cast in the film, he obviously had great affection for them, and he obviously was great friends with them and stuff. But at the same time, there is this sort of element of sort of condescension when he's talking sure. about them, and he almost is talking about them like they're children. But obviously, they're all grown adults, and they were obviously actively participating in this project of
some
their own free will.
Like they were definitely not elderly, but, you know, in their 40s or 50s. You know, maybe they aged faster, but they definitely looked like, you know, older people well beyond
absolutely
years themselves. Yeah.
And so, even just the meaning of the film is so difficult to interpret, because it, certainly in the times it was made, because it was shot around sort of 69, 70, around that period. I'm sorry, I can't remember the exact year that they filmed it. But this is, you know, you remember this would be a time when there was a lot of the student riots going on in Europe.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there was a real sort of counterculture sort of vibe sort of through popular culture of a bit of rebellion and a bit of, you know, people wanting to stand up to the status quo and change things and make the world a better place. All, you know, quite admirable, you know, things. I think we could use more of that now. But it's strange that he chose to make this film in that context at the time, because it is so, because it shows a rebellion, like an insurgence within this environment where all these people, you know, stand up to their oppressors, or who they feel are oppressing them anyway. And they start to, you know, stand up to that. But it very quickly descends, kind of like a Lord of the Flies. It sort of descends into the total anarchy and destruction, and, you know, where they start to destroy their very homes and their environment, and start to just sort of trash the place. So you have to wonder in that context about what exactly he was trying to say about, you know, about revolution and about, you know, the counterculture. It certainly seems like it runs at odds with with what was the popular sort of zeitgeist at the time.
Yeah, I don't see Werner Herzog hanging out with the hippy-dippy flower children. That's not his vibe, you know. And we've certainly spoken about some of that end of the myth of the 60s in numerous episodes of this podcast, as we're now in early 1971. So, yeah, I think that's a pretty great way to kind of bring this this conversation down by putting it back in that early 70s context as a commentary on its times, both Fata Morgana and Even Dwarf Started Small. So thank you, David. I really appreciate that synopsis of the film preceding the one we talked about at length today. So, and it's been a real blast having you on board. So thank you for joining me. Thank you for making the arrangements and for your obviously you know, dedicated research into these films. It's great.
Well, no, this was a lot of fun, David. Thanks for having me on. I mean, it's quite nice to be able to talk in depth, really, about some of these films, because it's nice to have that opportunity, actually. And it's just, like I said before, it's quite nice to finally talk to you, have a proper conversation with you, really, outside of the kind of Facebook-y sort of messages and stuff.
Dig deeper than social media would ever allow, unless you want to consider this a form of social media, which I suppose in some bigger definition it is. So that's going to wrap up our episode for today, listeners. We are going to be back fairly soon with a pretty significant release, Paolo Pasolini's The Decameron. So we've got a pretty good cast of guests lined up for that one. We'll be recording that next weekend, so we'll try to get that one mixed and out to you pretty soon. But thank you for listening in today. David, any final comments? Anything you want to say where listeners maybe can connect with you, maybe learn more about anything that you're doing online, or just get to know you better?
I don't really do a lot of the social media stuff anymore. I've kind of closed my Twitter account down and stuff like that, but people can still find me on the Facebook, the Criterion Now group. I do every once in a while go in and contribute there and kind of see what's going on. And there's lots of great people on there, showing our acquisitions and talking about films that are coming up for release and things like that. So I'm there, and I'm always happy to have a chat with anyone, and by all means, drop me a line and say hi.
Sure. Well, I will include your Facebook link in the show notes so people can go right to you there. I'll post a link in the Criterion Now conversation group on Facebook, and we can dig further into these films or other early Herzog works, and let any of you listeners who want to get in the conversation and send us your opinions, you're welcome to do that. So find us in the comments section or listen to us next time we're up. But thanks for tuning in, everybody. Goodbye.
Oh, you are really such a pretty one. I see you've gone and changed your name again. And just when I climb this whole mountainside to wash my eyelids in the rain, oh, so long, Marianne. And we began to laugh and cry and laugh about it all.